John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, 23rd of May, 2012. A statement that the EU supports peaceful protest, news of a much expanded settlement near Gilo, north of Bethlehem, and a Christian mother with four sons in Israeli jails. All this and more, stay tuned. A statement issued by the spokesperson of the EU's High Representative, Catherine Ashton, yesterday said that the European Union defends the right of Palestinians to hold peaceful protests against illegal Israeli settlement construction on their land. The statement came after an Israeli military court on Sunday convicted Nabi Saleh activist Bassem Tamimi of urging youths to throw rocks at security forces and of leading illegal anti-occupation protests in his Ramallah area village. Quote, "The EU considers Bassem Tamimi to be a human rights defender committed to non-violent protest against the expansion of an Israeli settlement on lands belonging to his West Bank village of Nabi Saleh. The EU attended all court hearings in his case and is concerned at the use of evidence based on the testimony of a minor who was interrogated in violation of his rights," end quote, added the spokesperson. Man News Agency reported today on a Christian family whose four sons have all been imprisoned by the Israeli military. Quote, "Since 2004, the whole family did not gather, not even once. Someone is always missing," end quote, said Alexandra Halabi, the Christian mother of the four sons. At present, all four are in jail, but one may be released shortly. Other women visiting relatives in prison were often surprised when they saw Alexandra and her daughter wearing crosses and said it was unusual to find Christians in jail. She tells them, quote, "Religion is for God and the country is for everyone. If I'm Christian, don't I have a homeland?" End quote. Givat Hamatos is on the southern fringes of the city limits of Jerusalem, close to the Gilo settlement and just north of Bethlehem. It was once a small, quaint area with homes dotted on it, but there are now major plans for 2,610 housing units and 1,100 hotel rooms. These extensive plans were released earlier in the year, but the speed with which planning and approval of these plans have proceeded is unprecedented. If this expected development goes ahead, the result will be that Palestinian cities and neighbourhoods will be cut off from Bethlehem, and Bethlehem further cut off from Jerusalem. This development has to be considered alongside further expansion of the settlements of Gilo and Har Homer, also close to Bethlehem. With up to 35% of Palestinian economic activity centred on a line that stretches from Bethlehem to East Jerusalem to Ramallah, these illegal extensions to already illegal settlements will make this economic link even more difficult. In other news, Israeli forces invaded several areas of the West Bank on Tuesday, abducted 6 Palestinians, will interview a 7th, and transfer the 6 detainees to unknown destinations. The towns invaded were Beit Amar, near the southern city of Hebron, Azun, east of Qalqilia, and Yamun, near the northern city of Nablus. In Gaza, tanks and bulldozers entered the Gaza Strip from the Kossoufim military gate northeast of Khan Yunis and moved north towards Deir al-Balah. Israeli forces regularly invade the territory of the Gaza Strip and prohibit the approach of any Palestinian within a distance of 300 metres of the border, preventing the use of a large portion of Gaza's limited arable land. And that's all today from IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday the 23rd of May daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hossam Cassis and William Temple.
Afghanistan, Monday. A NATO soldier of unreported nationality was killed by insurgents in eastern Afghanistan. Yemen, Monday. A suicide bomber killed more than 100 people at a rehearsal for a military parade in the Yemeni capital. Afghanistan, last night. Unknown fighters kidnapped 2 foreign aid workers, both of them women, and their 3 Afghan colleagues in the remote province of Badakhshan in northeast Afghanistan, according to official reports. Pakistan, today. At least 4 alleged militants were killed after a suspected U.S. drone strike in North Waziristan, 2 Pakistani intelligence officials reported. New Zealand, announced yesterday. New Zealand troops will withdraw from Afghanistan in 2013, not 2014 like Obama was hoping. Chicago, United States, Monday. French President Francois Hollande told reporters after the NATO summit that French troops are being withdrawn from Afghanistan starting right now. All but trainers will be home by the end of the year. He called this non-negotiable. Mr. Barack Obama, your coalition in Afghanistan is falling apart just like George W. Bush's did in Iraq. Now is the time to emulate the French example, pull the plug, and bring U.S. soldiers home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
On December 31, 2011, President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which carries several ominous provisions. However, Section 1021 of the NDAA is the most alarming in that it empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. Two lawyers, Carl J. Mayer and Bruce Affron, filed a lawsuit on January 13, 2012, on behalf of seven high-profile plaintiffs challenging the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act. Plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and linguist, Noam Chomsky. On May 16th, Federal Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a preliminary injunction that bars the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention under Section 1021, finding that the law violates rights of free speech and due process. Your reporter spoke with Carl J. Mayer, one of the two lawyers who filed the NDAA lawsuit, who talks about his recent court victory and the challenges ahead for the goal of overturning the law.
Section 1021, I think, poses the greatest challenge to civil liberties in America since the McCarthy era. What Section 1021 did is it would allow the military to put in indefinite detention anyone that, in the government's eyes, were engaged in the following, quote, substantially supporting al-Qaeda or, quote, associated forces of al-Qaeda. So this standard is so nebulous that it can encompass anyone. It can encompass journalists, writers, activists, and in fact, those were precisely the seven plaintiffs that were in this case. We call them the Freedom Seven, and they are Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary Pentagon whistleblower and author of the Pentagon Papers. There is Chris Hedges, the former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times and currently journalist for Truthdig. There was Noam Chomsky. Another plaintiff is a woman named Birgitta Jonsdottir, who was a member of Iceland's parliament and was associated with the WikiLeaks effort. And then there were three young leaders, Kaiwar Gala, who was one of the founders of Occupy London, Alexa O'Brien, who is a founder of U.S. Day of Rage, which is associated with Occupy Wall Street, and a young leader named Tangerine Boland, who is a founder of a group called Revolution Truth. So those are the plaintiffs that stood up, and I think I described in short order, the onerous provision of Section 1021.
Explain to our listeners a bit of what Federal Judge Catherine Forrest based her decision on to call for a preliminary injunction against Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Well, what was so onerous about this legislation is that it would allow any of the group I mentioned before, like our plaintiffs, anyone the government deemed to, quote, substantially support al-Qaeda or associated forces, it would allow the government to, number one, place these people in indefinite military detention, quote, until, quote, the end of hostilities, which is potentially forever in the war on terrorism, or try these people in a military court, not a civilian court where you get to go before jury appears, or render these people to a foreign country. So those are the three things the government could do under this. And what Judge Forrest courageously did was enforce the Constitution and rule that the First Amendment protects all of these people in their activities and protects all journalists in their activities. For now, we have a victory. The government has 60 days to decide whether or not to appeal. Even if they do, it's going to be a long time on this appeal. And during that time span, the injunction will stay in place. Or, and this is what we've been calling on the government to do, it's really high time for the administration to own up to the fact that this statute is wholly unconstitutional. It needs to be expunged permanently. And President Obama, the former constitutional scholar, he understands perfectly well that this is unconstitutional, and he should recognize that by directing his Justice Department to enter into a stipulation that from now that they will accept a permanent injunction against the NDAA. And that's what they need to do. I hope that other federal judges will read this opinion and take stock of what Judge Forrest has done. And also, I think that citizens should understand that you can, and the young lawyers will understand that you can fight the federal government and win in court. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's something you must try to do, in addition to the protests and other activities that we need to take our country back.
As you said, we don't know at this point whether the federal government will appeal this case, and it could take many more months to find out where this ends up. But are you concerned that this case could land before the Supreme Court with its conservative majority and its history of favoring extraordinary measures by the government and military in the war against terrorism?
It would take a while to go up to the court. In the meantime, we have prevailed, but it is a concern. However, it's not an overwhelming concern because Judge Forrest was very good in her opinion in citing Supreme Court precedent that was authored by the conservative justices. For example, she cited Citizens United, which is a case probably familiar to your listeners, which is a very aggressive First Amendment opinion that protects the corporation's right of free speech to spend money on elections. Now, this is a case I do not agree with in the least, but this is actually the first useful citation of Citizens United, I think, ever, because essentially what Judge Forrest was saying is, if you're going to extend maximum free speech rights to corporations, you have to extend them to citizens, journalists, activists, etc. There were a number of citations that Judge Forrest made to opinions by the Supreme Court authored by the Conservative Five that I think will help this opinion stand the test of time.
That was Carl J. Mayer, one of two lawyers representing plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging indefinite detention provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act. Find links to more information and analysis on the constitutionality of the law by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 18th and 19th of May, the G8, the eight richest nations on Earth, met at Camp David. Originally, they were going to meet in Chicago alongside the NATO summit, but after adbusters called for 50,000 protesters to lay siege to Chicago, the G8 ran like rabbits, moving the meeting to Camp David to avoid protesters. It didn't quite work. Both Frederick, Maryland and Thurmont, Maryland had protests against the G8. Frederick is the second largest city in Maryland, maybe half an hour at most from Camp David, and Thurmont is just outside the perimeter. Frederick also hosts Occupy Frederick. Here's what things sounded like when Occupy Frederick and the Anarchist Alliance DC Network marched against the G8 on May 18th in Frederick.
No bombs! No tanks! Burn the fucking banks! No bombs! No tanks! Burn the fucking banks! No bombs! No tanks! Burn the fucking banks!
The other side's cavalry.
Anticapitalista! Anticapitalista!
The next day, some of the participants in that march boarded buses for Chicago, chasing the CEOs of the eight richest nations on Earth to Chicago, where the modern heirs of Al Capone were about to meet for the NATO summit in the face of huge protests. One anti-war march in Chicago was estimated at 75,000 people by one source. Another report said it was 10 blocks long. Meanwhile, inside the G8 summit, the G8 agreed, in the face of the defeat of pro-bailout, pro-austerity political parties in both Greece and France, to take the focus off of austerity and budget control and focus on economic growth instead. Austerity may have just been defeated in Europe.
From the moment plans were announced to hold the NATO Military Coalition and G8 Economic Summit meetings in Chicago during May, peace and economic justice activists began organizing demonstrations to oppose the war in Afghanistan while linking military spending to harsh budget cuts and unemployment. But in March, the White House abruptly changed the location of the G8 summit, moving it to Camp David in Maryland. Undaunted, protest organizers moved ahead with their plans, and thousands of activists arrived in Chicago to greet more than 50 world leaders as they arrived in Chicago for the NATO gathering May 20th and 21st. In a week of actions beginning May 14th, protest organizers with the Coalition Against NATO G8 War and Poverty Agenda held a wide variety of events and protests focusing on war, peace, the environment, and economic inequality. In advance of the week's major protests, Chicago police raided several homes and arrested five activists on terrorism-related charges, citing plans for attacks in the city with Molotov cocktails and other incendiary devices. Civil liberties attorneys and activists decried the arrests for what they declared were trumped-up charges. On the largest day of protests on May 20th, more than 10,000 people marched through city streets toward McCormick Place, where the NATO summit was being held. During an emotionally charged moment on the march, U.S. veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars paused in an act of defiance to throw their medals away in the direction of the NATO gathering. After the march, Chicago police wielded their batons, beating some protesters bloody to clear the streets, living up to their malevolent reputation earned during protests decades earlier at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. Your reporter spoke with Pat Hunt, an organizer with a coalition protesting the NATO summit, who discusses the goals of the week of actions and the reasons behind what appears to be a revival of the nation's long-dormant peace movement.
Well, I was really proud of the people that came out and protested. There were so many actions that happened and so many different causes that came to light on how the policies of NATO and G8 affect people here in the United States. One of the things that we found when we were organizing this, the march and rally on the 20th and the People's Summit the weekend before on the 12th and 13th, was it really gave us an opportunity to have teach-ins and forums and panels and discussion about what NATO and G8 is, which doesn't happen very often in this country and certainly in Chicago, in the Chicago area. So we really got to raise the consciousness of people as to why we should be protesting NATO and G8. And with G8 leaving, we know that protests work. It was just kind of ironic that people with all the money and all the guns were scared of us. So the march and the rally went very, very well. We had a variety of speakers. Our guesstimate is between 10 and 15,000 people, but it's always hard to tell when you hit the streets. And then at the very end, the closing ceremony that the veterans did to return their medals was just beyond moving and really brought home some of the people that are truly affected by NATO's policies and actions around the world, the real damage that can cause. It was what we had hoped for, and it was a culmination of about 9 months worth of work.
Unfortunately, one aspect of these protests, as we've seen over many, many years, is police repression both before these demonstrations begin and during the demonstrations. Tell us a bit about the arrests that took place before the demonstrations started. At least five of those arrested charged with terrorist-related activities, and then you had a number of people injured on the streets who were attacked by police. We witnessed a lot of sort of very harsh treatment by the police of protesters in many areas of the city over these last few days.
Yeah, that's really been the dark side. During the course of the last week leading up to the weekend, as you said, five people were arrested. The homes were raided. The police arrested had no warrants, and they're being held on $1.5 million bond charged with terrorism and giving aid to terrorist organizations. And one of the things that led to the charges was they confiscated a home beer brewing kit and saying that they were making explosives out of that. And, you know, the city of Chicago would be arresting probably one in five people if they were going to arrest everybody that had a home brewing kit. So it's part of a pattern. It's a part of a pattern of trying to instill fear and uncertainty and be divisive. And it's a tactic that's been used, you know, for over 10 years, probably even longer. Happened at the RNC before the 2008 RNC. It happened in Minneapolis there where people were arrested for very similar charges. So it's happened many times before, and it's a way to try to, as I said, to be divisive and also to repress freedom of speech and freedom to assemble.
Pat, since the 2008 presidential elections, the peace movement in the United States has been fairly dormant. What do you think contributed to the success of getting so many more people out in the streets for this march and rally against NATO in Chicago than we've seen in quite some time?
I think there's a couple things. I think the Occupy movement was a huge part of it. We did a lot of outreach to the Occupy movement here in Chicago, which then did outreach to many of the other Occupies across the country. People came in from all over that identify themselves as with the Occupy movement of one city or another. And I think that another part of it is that there's an anger when you start seeing the dollars that are spent on NATO, and then you start hearing that they're cutting other services. And I think people are getting fed up. You know, I don't think it's quite at the point where it is at Greece yet, but people are fed up. People want something different. People aren't believing what the Obama administration is saying. And I think the other thing is we worked very, very hard to get a permit, and that permit battle became public, which was really our only option, was to make it public and win in the court of public opinion. And people saw that we were really fighting for their rights as well as for our right to have a permitted march. And I think people wanted to support that. And when they saw how difficult it was and how repressive the city was trying to be, I think it sort of shined a light for folks. And I think it was their way of supporting it.
That was Pat Hunt, an organizer with a coalition protesting the NATO summit. For more information and commentary on the NATO protests and police arrests of activists on terrorism charges, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Night on Saturday, the 19th of May, after an anti-NATO protest in Chicago, the Chicago police drew their guns and forcibly pulled over a car containing video journalists, including two live streamers known on Twitter as At TimCast and At Luke We Are Change. The cameras were still rolling as cops swarmed in, brandishing guns and shouting obscenities.
We're being raided right now. For those that are watching, we are being raided by the CPB as we speak.
Once the pigs approached the car, they were careful to make sure their voices could not be understood before shutting off the feed outright.
We saw cops coming up behind us. A gray, unmarked police car from Victoria. We don't know if it's a police car.
They shut my feed off.
All right. Now I just turned it back on. We're live back again. We just got pulled out of the car. Cops, ID's taken.
That's why passengers should never carry ID.
12 officers pulled us over. Took our.
We got a stream up right before the radio. We talked to an officer.
For those that are watching right now, for all that is holy, please tweet out. We just got raided. Multiple squad cars surrounded our vehicle right here. We were all pulled out, cuffed, and put up against the hood. A supervisor came by and fanned over to one of the other officers, and he pointed at us, swirled his finger. The police came over and uncuffed us and said, "We're sorry, your car looks like something that another car we were looking for." Earlier today, the apartment that we're staying at was raided. The person who lives there has given multiple stories, and we have no idea what's true and what's not.
Those lying cops. Yes. Assaulting the press at a big protest in Chicago, just like what happened in 1968 at the Democratic National Convention, something later described as a police riot in official reports. Needless to say, the YouTube video from which this sound was extracted was unavailable in a web browser as late as Sunday afternoon. Fortunately, YouTube's unavailable does not block specialized downloading tools. I've seen this blocking only twice, at the Chicago NATO protest and the Charlotte, North Carolina protest against the Bank of America board meeting. If the police keep assaulting the press,
YouTube just might stop blocking all that video. When credentialed journalists were beaten at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, they showed off their wounds on national TV. There was a second incident Saturday in which credentialed journalist Tracy Pollock from The Update was attacked by police as they used their bikes as weapons against a street march against NATO, relying on the First Amendment as the only permit they needed to assemble for redress of grievances. She was moving towards the protest from the police side of the line, was suddenly attacked, and had to be rescued by protesters. Just before she was attacked, one of the cops drew what looked like a long knife or dagger. That was a cop grabbing her camera lens and pushing her over the bikes. She was pulled to safety by protesters, receiving bruises but not serious injuries. She never crossed a police line under her own power. Matters could have been even worse, but an Illinois state law that cops had planned to interpret as making recording police a felony if audio could be heard was thrown out by the courts just days before the NATO summit began. In 1968, police violence against the press at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago was so bad that some said two new TV shows came out of that event, Beat the Press and Mace the Nation. On the 20th of May, a massive crowd stretching for 10 blocks marched through the streets of Chicago against the NATO summit. At the head of the march was members of Iraq Veterans Against the War. At the culmination of the protest, about 50 Iraq Veterans Against the War members returned medals they had been awarded serving NATO in Iraq and or Afghanistan.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. You look very beautiful today. This is a great turnout. My name is Jerry. I'm from New York City. I served in the Army from 2005 to 2009. I fought in Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. I today am giving back my Global War and Terrorism Service Medal because I realized that after a while that it was just nothing but an idea made by a bunch of politicians, money-hungry politicians in Washington who will do nothing and have a complete disregard for human life and will do anything in their power to just make more money in the end. Now if it's just an idea, then therefore it was just an idea that sparked two wars that I had to fight in. And I don't want any part of it anymore. And I choose human life over war, militarism, and imperialism.
My name is Scott Kimball. I'm an Iraq War vet. And I'm turning in these medals today for the people of Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and all victims of occupation across the world. And also, for all the service members and veterans who are against these wars, you are not alone!
My name is Christopher May. I left the Army as a conscientious objector. We were told that these medals represented, democracy and justice and hope and change for the world. These medals represent a failure on behalf of the leaders of NATO to accurately represent the will of their own people. It represents a failure on the leaders of NATO to do what's right by the disenfranchised people of this world. Instead of helping them, they take advantage of them. And they're making things worse. I will not be a part of that anymore. These medals don't mean anything to me, and they can have them back.
Even the cops stood by as Taps was then played. Unfortunately, it was not long afterwards that the Chicago cops decided to threaten people with tear gas and a whale war-style LRAD sound cannon in a futile attempt to disperse the massive crowd. The Rock Veterans Against the War also staged a retirement ceremony for the American flag. Given the behavior of the police, perhaps such a ceremony should also be held for the Constitution. After the massive march against NATO on the 20th of May in Chicago culminated in a throwing back of war medals by veterans, riot police in helmets, shields, and billy clubs attacked marchers in the street. Some say they were trying to disperse the march, yet other cops acted like they wanted to trap marchers. During the entire day, 45 people were arrested, and the Chicago police whined to the newspapers, alleging that someone responded to being clubbed and beaten by knifing one of them in the leg. Given that a cop pulled a knife during an attack on a journalist the previous day, how do we know that cop didn't fall on his own knife and cut his leg? Here's what the fighting sounded like. All that police violence didn't work. Marchers escaped the police attacks and thousands of people continued to march far into the night, at one point gathering outside a place where NATO delegates were eating. Even later that night, Chicago police brass may have lost control of their men on the street. There were reports of people leaving the bars being assaulted by Chicago police officers who seemed to be attacking anyone they thought might be a protester. A number of activists from Occupy DC were arrested on May 20th in a Chicago protest and subsequent police violence, but all were out by Monday morning. By 10 a.m. Monday, protests against NATO had resumed, with marches on the streets and even a highway. NATO, you can't win in Afghanistan, and you didn't win in Chicago on the 20th of May either. On the 18th of May, hundreds of D.C. residents showed up at Pepco's stockholders meeting, furious with Pepco's plans for a $42 million rate hike that will largely be absorbed by increases in the salaries of CEO Joe Rigsby and other senior Pepco executives. Looks like it's pitchforks and torches for Pepco's proposal to raise rates by $42 million to pay for a pay raise for CEO Joe Rigsby and the rest of Pepco's top executives. Inside the stockholders meeting were dozens of D.C. residents who'd purchased Pepco's stock so they could speak out at the stockholders meeting about rate hikes, lousy service, and Pepco's unbelievable greed. A poker face wasn't enough, and neither was the law. Although they were entitled by law to be part of the stockholders' meeting, Pepco packed the seats in the meeting room with Pepco employees, then shunted everybody off to an overflow room, and then decided that wasn't enough and had security guards beat, push, shove, and choke people before removing everybody from the building. The remaining stockholders then proceeded to approve a big fat pay raise for Pepco CEO Joe Rigsby.
Say that so.
I want to tell everybody exactly what happened. We went in at shareholders today. We walked in, there were two rows. There was a room to the left, there was a room to the right. We walked in and tried to get into the room in the back. All the shareholders were there, were holding a meeting. They start, employees of Pepco start pushing us. They start shoving us. They start choking us. They start pushing us in the table. They manhandled us and made us try to go into the next room. We demanded to go inside of the meeting so we could let our voices be heard. Shareholders in this company, and they shoved us into the glass, and they shoved us on the ground and pushed us out of there. This is an injustice. How dare Pepco treat its customers and shareholders like this?
That's right.
We went here peacefully, and we went in here and let our voices be heard, and we were manhandled, choked, and shoved by Pepco employees and security guards. We will not stand for this. Here in D.C., we will not stand for this.
shareholders meeting where D.C. residents can get in if you have a share, and we have paperwork that shows that we are shareholders. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No,
they push us, they push the woman outside. I never seen this. I thought people call her more professionally, but they are worse than I don't know who.
We got the worst company.
Yes, we are.
So my name is Valerie. I'm a loyal Petco customer. My bill for the last month was $300. In that meeting, I'm a shareholder of this company. And you know what they said? They said, you can't get in. You
can't get out.
So I demanded to get in. And what they did to me, they grabbed me. They pushed me aside. Then they got the cops to put their hands on me and pushed me out the door. You know what I did? I grabbed that door. Yeah. I was like, I am not leaving. I pulled that door open to make sure other shareholders don't have to go through what I went through.
Shareholders in the early 90s, my grandmother gave me about 1,500 shares that I invested in my education, and they wouldn't let me in. I had all the proper documentation. They had to call and verify my documentation, and by the time I got upstairs, they would only let me into the overflow room, and they said it was after 10 a.m. and the meeting had already started. To investigate my paperwork, and I'm just really upset. And my grandmother actually gave me this stock, and I think that she'd be really, really disappointed, and that she invested in such a terrible company. Like she would probably like roll over in her grave.
Petco needs to pay their fair share in taxes, like I did. I got to pay my taxes. They need to pay their fair share. They need to cut their compensation package in half. And they need to create jobs for the district residents.
Stop allowing
people from North Carolina to come up and trim trees.
They get into the Petco shareholders meeting today. Maybe my smile was nicer than Alana's, I don't know. I've never seen such evasive answers to questions that we posed. Dave and I both got to ask questions, and I asked about reliability. And I did mention a quote that Mr. Rigby gave to our county council. And apparently he was misquoted in the paper. But that doesn't address the reliability issues. My power still goes out every time the wind blows, and I lose a refrigerator full of food, and I can't work when there's no power, so I lose income. And in the meantime, the Petco executives all just voted themselves a big fat salary increase because they can't keep the lights on. I mean, you know, is it too much to ask to keep the lights on?
No!
So I don't think that the Petco executives should have gotten a salary increase today.
No!
No way.
Petco, if you're really dumb enough to think that you can keep right on raising people's rates so you can raise CEO and executive pay while the lights go out every time the wind blows and you buy your electricity from users of mountaintop removal coal, you've got another thing coming. The more you push people, the more people are going to push back. It's going to be pitchforks and torches over and over again. And who knows? Maybe people might decide to go on a rate strike where half the city stops paying their bills all at the same time. Petco? All I can say is zero for Petco until you clean up your act. And one more thing. That was a big boo-boo kicking out somebody who had 1,500 shares of stock inherited from a grandmother. You just might be hearing about that one from the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Since the world sank into deep recession in 2008, economic cooperatives have emerged to provide a proven alternative to market failures in places as diverse as coffee growers in Kenya to the Rust Belt in the United States. According to the news magazine In These Times, an estimated 1 billion people are members of cooperatives, producing earnings equal to the gross domestic product of Canada. During the Great Depression, cooperatives were launched in the housing and manufacturing sector. Later, co-ops gained popularity during the 1960s, when many community health food outlets were founded. When the Occupy Wall Street movement was born last fall, activists tapped into the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives, with organizers calling for the new protest movement to create an economy worth occupying, as many promoted the cooperative business model. One of the most famous examples of successful worker cooperatives in the world is found in the Mondragon region of Spain, which has survived Spain's economic turmoil. But the cluster of worker enterprises has now created two forms of membership, diluting the ability of workers to vote their co-op shares. In Argentina, where occupied factories were transformed into cooperatives in the early part of the decade, enthusiasm has waned as co-ops seek legal status. Economist Gar Alperovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, has urged the Occupy movement to move beyond street protests to create new independent institutions, including worker-owned cooperatives. In Chicago, Occupy activists have joined with the United Electrical Workers Union to buy the Republic Windows and Doors factory that was famously taken over by its workers after owners shut the plant down in 2008.